OG, we are back reporting for duty for another 8 weeks of podcasting.
Yay.
That's the type of excitement we bring to the table here at the Stacky Benjamin Show. But you know something you can get excited about kicking off these 8 weeks with our shout out to the men and women in our armed forces. How about that? Can you get behind that one?
Get excited about.
Give us a little more enthusiasm there. On behalf of the men and women of Navy Federal Credit Union, a big shout out to the men and women serving in our armed forces. Let's all go stack some Benjamins, peeps.
Here's the song that we'd like to do for all the younger set of people, the teenagers and what have you. This one's called Vacation Zope.
Vacation's all that is.
It's over. It's over.
Live from Joe's mom's basement, it's the Stacking Benjamin Show. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and do you want to get ahead without burning bridges along the way? Well, with help from today's guest, you'll learn how to achieve more and skip being a jerk altogether. Join me in welcoming David Bodanis. Plus, as we begin football season in America, and for those of you listening around the world, I'm talking about the real football, not that one where you actually touch the ball with your feet. Oh. Well, anyway, one American football team is partnering with FinTech to educate its fans. And we'll get all cryptic about crypto during our TikTok minute. Later, we'll toss out the Haven Lifeline to Leah, who's in a good financial position to buy a house, but with house prices being sky high, should she buy now or maybe hold off for a bit? And I'll share some very cool trivia. And now, two guys who are probably just waiting for home prices to crash before getting a basement of their own, it's Joe and O-J-J-J-J-G.
We've been telling mom that for 8 years, just waiting for the prices to cool. Then we'll go find our own space. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Zero Rent for the Win podcast. I'm Joe Saul Sehy, Average Joe Money on Twitter. Happy September. We're so happy to be back. The team is refreshed, excited. We got David Bodanis coming down to the basement from England. That's where he is now. However, he doesn't have the British accent. He is more of a Chicago accent because that's where he's...
Good day, mate.
He's originally exactly like that. More important than David Bodanis, though, that multilingual gentleman sitting across from me is the one and only OG.
Yeah, I can speak English in four languages.
I can speak that language in four different bad dialects.
No, it's all different. I'm certain of it.
It's all totally different.
I'm bilingual twice.
I speak pig Latin.
Squared.
Kind of. Very slowly.
I wonder if the kids would get that. That'd be kind of fun.
David Bodanis, for many years, taught the intellectual toolkit course at Oxford. If you're not familiar with David Bodanis's work, I'm so excited that we've got him coming on. Of course, he also wrote this best-selling book called Equals MC Squared, which PBS turned into this documentary, Einstein's Big Idea, which was absolutely amazing. But this project of his, How to Get Ahead Without Being a Jerk. The art of fairness. Can you get there? Can you stack more Benjamins? And as you can probably believe, his answer is yes, but it ain't easy.
You should be taking a lot of notes.
Thanks. On that note, let's get this party started because we've got some fantastic headlines. But first, this episode is sponsored by State Farm. You a small business owner looking for insurance that fits your needs and budget? Well, look no further than State Farm. State Farm agents are not just insurance providers, they're also small business owners who live and work right here in your community. They understand the unique challenges of running and protecting a small business. When it comes to small business insurance, State Farm knows what it takes. Create a plan that fits your needs and your budget. State Farm agents are ready to help you choose personalized policies that truly understand your business. Insure your small business with a fellow small business owner. Talk to a State Farm agent today and get started on personalized small business insurance that fits your needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today. Ready for an awesome episode? Well, so are we. But you know what? Before we get to it, I got to tell you that members of Navy Federal Credit Union could earn more and save more. Bam! Not all financial institutions offer you as many choices for savings options as our friends at Navy Federal do. Start your savings journey with a low minimum deposit. For example, you could open an Easy Start certificate for just $50. And then how many certificates do this? You can then add money at any time and watch your savings grow. To learn more, visit NavyFederal.org. At Navy Federal, our members are the mission. Navy Federal is insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Lender. Membership required. Terms and conditions apply. Loan subject to approval. This episode is sponsored by State Farm. You a small business owner looking for insurance that fits your needs and budget? Well, look no further than State Farm. State Farm agents are not just insurance providers. They're also small business owners who live and work right here in your community. They understand the unique challenges of running and protecting a small business. When it comes to small business insurance, State Farm knows what it takes. Create a plan that fits your needs and your budget. State Farm agents are ready to help you choose personalized policies that truly understand your business. Insure your small business with a fellow small business owner. Talk to a State Farm agent today and get started on personalized small business insurance that fits your needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today. And now we can get rolling. Let's go into a very interesting headline on fintech.
Hello, darlings. And now it's time for your favorite part of the show, our Stacking Benjamin's Headlines.
In our first headline, football meets finance meets fintech. Pro football's back, OG.
College football's back, which is exponentially better than pro football.
College football has been back for a couple weeks. My Michigan State Spartans not looking as rotten as I was thinking they might.
What do they want to know?
Well, at the time we record this, hopefully by the time people listen to this, they're 2-0.
Who they got this weekend? Such a fan, I can tell, as he gets out the Googler.
As I'm looking it up.
Yeah, they are playing a team this week that hopefully they should beat. They are playing the
it's the Youngstown State.
Oh, FCS program. That would be embarrassing to lose to.
Here's the big question. What is Youngstown State's mascot?
The fighting, I don't know.
The Penguins.
Yes.
Penguins. Indeed. For the win. Of course. Yes. But hopefully Michigan State wins that game. And yes, we're 2-0, OG. And if we're not, I'm going to have both Youngstown State fans that also listen to the show are going to be all over my craw.
You should make a bet with them. Like Trevor Lawrence said, he had to wear all Georgia gear after the Clemson-Georgia game 2 weeks ago.
I'll have to go buy some Youngstown State gear.
Someone will send it to you.
Yes. And I'll have to wear it on our YouTube channel.
But pro football is starting.
All right. Yeah, one team, San Francisco 49ers, according to this investment news piece written by Nicole Kasperson, is partnering up with Stash, the online brokerage with over 6 million users, to promote financial literacy and wealth building to millions of fans. Nicole writes that together the organization will push Stash's financial literacy program, Stash 101, which launched following Stash acquisition of PayGrade, a platform that provides teachers with a finance curriculum designed around simulated banking and investing. Stash 101 comes on the heels of the fintech's recent entrance into the robo-advice space, a fresh $125 million funding round, and a surge in its assets under management to more than $3 billion. This is an interesting partnership, OG, because I think when you hit up a football stadium full of people and you're introducing them to financial literacy, something that that apparently they're also, by partnering with the 49ers, are getting some of the players involved and also working with any platform where people are watching the 49ers, you've got this much better ability to reach people that otherwise might not be reached. We often hear that people say the information's not out there. You and I have been here long enough to know the information's out there. Nobody's just really looking for it. Maybe putting it in people's face while they're trying to watch their favorite football team. Maybe that'll be helpful.
You can run an ad like, did you just lose your mortgage payment on DraftKings? Is your fantasy team not doing what it's supposed to? Maybe take some of that money and invest it with us.
Build your own financial franchise.
Marketing copy.
There it is.
Hope they're writing it down.
Hey, Stash, if you would like to hire us, Joe and OG here at Stacking Benjamins.
We are available. I think that anytime that you can figure out a way to deliver content by having something else wrapped around it, there's a better chance that people are going to consume it.
Braden Krieg, the CEO of Stash, agrees with you. He says, the sooner young people are exposed to core money skills and concepts, from budgeting to credit to taxes, the sooner they'll feel empowered to invest in themselves and get started on their unique journeys toward financial freedom. $20, by the way, says that Brandon didn't actually say that. His marketing team put those words in his mouth. But that doesn't mean they're wrong, OG. Yeah. The earlier you get at people, I mean, look at what's going on in high schools all over the place. People are getting maybe tangentially a little bit of the right news from places like Robinhood because all their friends are betting on stocks now. But it seems like with all that frenzy, it's a great time for fintech firms to take advantage of the gamification, show people maybe some better opportunities.
Perfect time as the SEC is cracking down on it. Yes.
What, crack it out on Robinhood?
Nah, just the whole gamification thing, actually. But no, you're right. When it comes to ways to interact with people, I doubt that, you know, people at the 49ers games are going to be like, you know what? I probably shouldn't have that popcorn. I'm going to save that based on that ad I saw. You know, I'm not going to drink that third beer for $14. I'll invest that in this app instead. But if there's something that they can see there and see again another place and then see when, you know, the 49ers are on the road and they're sitting on their couch and they have the opportunity to play on their phone at the exact same time, I think there's a better likelihood. And although I am interested in the young people discussion, is the average age of NFL viewership young?
I don't know about the NFL. I know the MLB has struggled with that, which is why, and sadly, what I'm seeing anyway, is MLB appears to be wholeheartedly embracing betting on the games.
Yeah.
To bring the age down.
If they would let the players bet, that would be more exciting.
Let Pete Rose into the Hall of Fame. Finally.
And let him bet on games, like openly. He can bet on the game. I'm kidding. That would be a bad idea.
You talk about the SEC cracking down on gamification. Do you think that gamification is really the problem, or is it kind of what David Bodanis is going to talk about today? Like doing it for good, right? Versus being a jerk and getting people to do things that they shouldn't do. I mean, I feel like some of the gamification that Robinhood uses as an example are around getting people to do things that might be detrimental to their overall financial health, investing money in risky stuff that they probably shouldn't be putting into the stock market. Where I think other gamification that helps people look at Acorns, people rounding up their purchases when they go to a retailer and investing these little bits of money, not harmful, but the gamification aspect helps people get in.
Use your powers for good, not evil, I guess, huh?
I'm also wondering about something else here. As researching this piece, I saw that Michael Jordan getting involved in an app for estate planning. Apollo Anton Ono just joined the personal capital marketing campaign. Also, Betterment is working with Maggie Siff. You might not know the name Maggie Siff, but if you've seen the show Billions, you know that she's the psychiatrist Wendy Rhodes. And so I think partnering with the psychologist.
She was also the girlfriend in Sons of Anarchy.
Oh.
So kind of a wide-ranging career there.
And of course, Acorns, backed by Jennifer Lopez, A-Rod, Bono, Ashton Kutcher, Kevin Durant. But this idea of superstars going that way, it feels like, man, fintech's hot right now.
Are all those people getting into it to help the everyday guy or gal? J-Lo's like, you know, I just need to help my fans.
I think we need more financial literacy and I can get rich.
Right.
I mean, that's what nice people do. I'm sure David Bodanis is going to say that. Just when you get wealthy, just take other people with you, right? It's nothing wrong with getting rich. And I also think getting rich and helping people be more financially literate and do the right things with their money. I don't have any stank on that.
Do well by doing good.
Hey, and on that note, Acorn that I just brought up, but for those of you that don't know the app Acorns, its core product is rounding up your purchases and the money that you do that with goes into an index fund. They're going public in the second half this year and they're using a SPAC to go public.
Okay.
You look at all of these, you know, we talk about all these celebrities and we joke about them getting rich. If this is an emerging area, is this someplace maybe we put a few bucks?
Well, again, you're not going to get the actual IPO price. So it's just like any other investment. I mean, people get wrapped up in IPOs like there's some kind of magic pill that pretends financial independence immediately or something, but it's no different than any other investment. It's got to be profitable. It's got to be a company that has a strategic moat around it, that has the ability to continue to grow and isn't just about the distribution of assets to the shareholders. I mean, sometimes a public offering happens because of the fact that it's owned by so many different layers of people. As they continue to build, they have to add more investors, and more investors put more money into it. And if those investors want to get paid out, and so the way that they get paid out is by selling the company. They sell it publicly. So that kind of first layer of wealth has already been created. It's like buying Dogecoin at 40 cents going, at least I'm going to go from 40 cents to $4. It's like the real money was made when it was 0.0000001 cent, and that went to 40 cents. That was where all the real money was made.
Bam.
Now, it doesn't mean that it's always the case. Obviously, Amazon IPO'd in the 90s and now it's worth, you know, many multiples more than that, but it's a long investment. It's not a short get rich quick type of thing. So if you're going to add any stock, whether it's Acorns or any other publicly traded company, it's got to be additive to your portfolio and it's got to have a specific purpose. If you're doing it for fun money, then who cares? None of that matters. It's fun money.
Yeah. I was worried about that with an IPO. And by the way, with this being a SPAC means it isn't a true IPO, right? So this is going to be...
It's like a reverse. It's, you know, the money's already there and then they kind of sort of acquire it later and you have to guess which SPAC it is and, you know.
Yeah, they call this a blank check merger because you really don't know what you're buying into. You know, if you're the average investor buying into this, you're throwing darts at the beginning, which I love what you say there, OG. It's still got to be about the fundamentals, right? You can look at all the people that are involved in this. And in fact, Acorns is backed by PayPal Ventures, BlackRock, Ashton Kutcher, Jennifer Lopez, Dwayne Johnson, and more. You know, you can't just look at the list of other people that are doing it because their net worth, they can withstand a big, huge loss with some of their money.
But they're not going to keep their money there. That's my point. Like, you know, they put in their $1 million when it was worth $20 million. Now it's worth $200 million. They're getting their 10x return right now.
This is the event for them to get out while you're getting in.
Exactly.
They're using your money to get out.
Yeah. Yeah. The 10x was already made for them. The next 10x may happen, but it's not going to happen in the same time or fashion generally is.
You know, that's one reason why they go public. Another reason is it's a huge influx of cash for the company. And actually the CEO of Acorn says that they want that cash so that they can, quote, accelerate our growth and get the tools of responsible wealth making in everyone's hands as fast as possible when they need it most, CEO Noah Koerner said.
And also because they want to be rich.
I look at responsible wealth building though, and I think I don't have the liquidity to do that now. Is this the best use of money? I don't know. Once again, to your point, hard to tell what the motivation is when it's an IPO. And there's so many companies out there that have been public for a long time where we can get that information and we know what we're investing in. Acorns sounds cool, but who knows? You know, another point on this, OG, that I wanted to talk about is all of this fintech sexiness and hotness. We talked about Robinhood earlier, but a lot of it is, it goes back to the stonk trading, right? The GameStop and AMC. Have you kept up with what's going on with either one of those companies recently?
No. I mean, I kind of sort of know.
Yeah.
But not as of the last month or so.
GameStop, as we're recording this, is getting ready to declare earnings at the close of business today. They still have yet to show a profit. They still have yet to show any turnaround. It'll be interesting because when you look at the plan that GameStop's gotten so much hype with, it'll be exciting to see what GameStop does. But we do have more information on AMC. AMC over Labor Day weekend beat their record, which is 8 years old, according to CEO Adam Aron. AMC attracted about 800,000 moviegoers to its international theaters across Europe and the Middle East as well. They really broke it on the back of the new Disney Marvel movie, Shang-Chi. In fact, the exciting thing for AMC is they had more people in theaters than they had pre-pandemic. People thought that people, OG, were going to take their time getting back to the movie theater. People flooding back.
Not so much, huh?
Yeah. Here's the thing about AMC. If all this discussion that, you know, me going into this makes you go, oh, maybe I should look at AMC. Maybe not so fast. It still hasn't gotten back just above $70, which is where it was. However, if you just look at it this year, Shares are up 2,300% year to date. I think you want to get into a stock before it goes up 2,300%, maybe not after.
Just right before it does.
Yeah, the day before.
Preferably.
If you can do that. Which I think, you know, we're joking about that, OG, but it's a good reminder that this is maybe for most people listening a game best not played.
Well, it's not. I mean, using AMC as an example, it's easy to look at the, well, it was $2 a share and now it's at 50. Dang, I should have. But where along the way over the last, oh, I don't know, 5-8 years, would you have said that this was a good stock to own? With all of the information that you knew about Hulu and Netflix and when Disney came out with theirs and Amazon Prime and all that other sort of stuff, January of 2014, AMC stock was at $20 a share. And then it was worth 30 a year later. And then it was worth 20 a year after that. And then it was worth 30 a year after that. And then it was worth 15 a year after that.
Right.
You know, and then it was worth 15 a year after that. And then in the pandemic, it was worth 6 and then 3 and then 2. And oh my God, it's worth, you know, 60 and then 30 and now 50 again. So where in that 8-year cycle did you go, yeah, AMC is a good stock to own. The only reason you bought it at 3 was because you thought you were going to get lucky. There was no investing strategy there.
No, it was clearly a gamble that paid off.
For some people. So it's still not an investment to have.
Yeah, I think if you're looking for predictable stocks, this hasn't been a stock that you can predict where it heads next. Then again, which stock can you predict? But this one I think has been especially difficult. Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com/welcome to now. And before we play it, because this is a little involved, the video starts off with this wizard, Hoji, talking to Ethereum, called Etheria in the video, asking to see Fiat, who, by the way, you'll hear at the end of this video, and who also notices, not happily, that gold has shown up too in this little fantasy setting. This is via the crypto couple.
Oh boy.
I see a friend of mine. Sir Ethrock, have you seen Fiat around here? Don't worry about Bitcoin. She's just volatile because she's about to start a super cycle.
Are you seriously talking to a rock?
It's an ETH rock and it's worth more than you are.
Yeah, in fiat, which is gross.
Richard Nixon, you son of a...
Oh my God, it's gold.
The gold? Like the prehistoric version of you?
Wow.
I was trying to keep up with inflation. And then Peter Schiff caught me and trapped me in his basement. I've been there for over 10 years. Wait... Who are you guys?
Hello, brother.
And that's Fiat showing up, seeing gold. Hello, brother.
That sounds like the dumbest thing that's on the internet right now.
The prehistoric version of you, Bitcoin. Peter Schiff locked me up in his basement. Come on.
Nope. No joy.
Gold? Didn't like that one.
Did not.
All right. If you got something better to share with us, I think the lesson here is that everybody's trying to, you've got fiat, you've got Bitcoin, you got Ethereum, you've got whoever this wizard is, and you have gold, all vying to be the standard. Richard Nixon. No, just nothing.
Sorry, bro. It didn't land well.
Joe at stackingbenjamins.com. If you have one that's better for OG, to see if you can make OG laugh at your TikTok video or groan or whatever, help us out. Joe at stackybenjamins.com. I think on that note, I'll just get out of the way. It's getting uncomfortable here, and maybe let Doug have his rant about the, well, about the flipping heat. Did you notice it's getting hot down here?
Hey there, Stackers. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug. And in just a little bit, you're going to hear from David Bondanis. But one problem that David can't fix is that broken AC vent. I've been telling Joe and OG about it for weeks, but since it's only affecting my side of the basement over by the canned peaches, no one seems to care. How hot is it in here, you ask? It's so hot, you can't make a chili dog. It's so hot that my chocolate milk is now hot cocoa. It's so hot that I'm sweating like Joe Biden after a Taliban resurgence. What? Too soon? I mean, come on, we made fun of Trump, so I think we can do this one too. I can keep going all day, but I mean, you probably get it by now. That actually reminds me of today's trivia question. What is the number one company for air conditioner sales in the U.S.? I'll be back with your answer faster than you can cool your jets about that Biden joke.
Well, I know you know this already, OG, but when you become a member of Navy Federal Credit Union, life gets better, huh? Doesn't it?
Does. It's way better.
It's funny. Every time that I bought a car before Navy Federal, a little frustrating, got to tell you, but the last couple cars that I purchased, so much easier. And it's mostly because of that TrueCar thing. You can save thousands off MSRP with Navy Federal's car buying service, which is powered by TrueCar. It is so amazing. And I have saved thousands of dollars. Plus, as a Navy Federal member, you're going to get member benefits like exclusive member savings with Carfax, Geico, Sirius XM. They're always available with 24/7 member service representatives to answer any questions you have. You can finance if you need a loan, buy the car for less, protect it, enjoy your auto purchase all through one convenient place. And of course, they have low rates and pre-approval good for 90 days, so you know what you can afford while you shop. Remember, start off in your head, not with a payment you can afford, but with a car that you can afford. And then if you have to finance it, which remember, this is a depreciating asset, guys. If you have to finance it, then Navy Federal is a great place to start. Learn more at NavyFederal.org/car buying. That's NavyFederal.org/car buying. Credit and collateral subject to approval. Your actual savings off MSRP may vary. Navy Federal Credit Union is federally insured by NCUA. Stackers, controlling your money on a day-to-day basis comes down to two things. Number one, great communication, either with yourself or with a partner. And by great communication, what do I mean? I mean, sitting down with your app of choice and putting together your strategy based on what you spent the week before. It's super easy, a 20-minute meeting a week. You look through your expenses and then you plot out, what are you going to do next week? And you know what? That might seem little, but the big things stem from that. And if you have an app that keeps that in front of you, that helps make it even easier. And the app Cheryl and I use is Monarch Money. We've been using it now for about a year. As you may know, I've used lots of different solutions, and this is by far the one I've stuck with the longest. It helps Cheryl and I collaborate. We can talk about our financial goals. For us, it's travel. We're also adding to our house. We have a goal in a few years to really work on our lawn as well and just make it a pretty place to live. But the travel piece, as you know, if you've listened to me for any amount of time, that's a big one. And what's cool is I can put our financial independence goals and our journey up right next to our budget, because everything at Monarch is very intuitive. It is very customizable. So what the heck is Monarch? You're sitting there wondering to yourself, aren't you? Person I just made up. Yes. Let me tell you what it is. It's an all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you comprehensive view of all your accounts, your investments, your transactions, and more. You can create custom budgets, track your progress toward your financial goals, and collaborate with your partner. And now, Stackers, because you're a stacker, you're going to get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/Benjamins. Got to have the /Benjamins to get the extended 30-day free trial so you can see that you'll like it as much as I do. How does it work? Well, it's very intuitive. It has a simple, intuitive design that makes it easy to set up, customize, and use. You can collaborate with your partner, family, or your financial advisor. What's cool is you can invite all these people to your account at no extra cost, so you can collaborate and everybody gets their own login info and everybody gets a joint view of your finances. And as I mentioned earlier, it's customizable, and best yet, it's ad-free privacy you can trust. No ads. You're not being marketed. When I had other apps that were free, I got marketed all the time. Well, not only do they not do that, they also don't sell your data to third parties. After trying out Monarch for myself and using it for about a year now on a daily basis, I totally get why it's the top-rated personal finance app. And right now, because you're a stacker, you're going to get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/Benjamins. That's Monarch Money, MONARCHMONEY.com/Benjamins for your extended 30-day free trial.
Hey, Hey there, Stackers. It's Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and I've just been venting my frustration to Joe, but he still doesn't seem to get it. He doesn't understand that it's so hot that Tabasco sauce tastes mild. It's so hot that I'm using Celsius instead of Fahrenheit just to have a lower number. I mean, I can't even. As soon as it's Doug's issue around here, it's like it's not an issue at all. Hopefully these yahoos will take a lesson or two from David Bodanis about being diplomatic and the power of listening. I said listen! But before I pass things to David, let's get back to today's trivia. The question was, what is the number one company for air conditioner sales in the U.S.? Coming in at number three, it's Trane. At number two, it's Daikin. And finally, the big number one is Carrier. Now let's carry this over to Joe and special guest, David Bodanis. See ya!
And on my dad's shortwave radio, all the way from London. I'm so happy he's here with us. David Bodanis joins us. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you very, very much for having me.
Well, I'm super excited to get into this. I have about 8 hours worth of questions. I'm going to try to squeeze them into 20 or 25 minutes for our audience. But you pack so much into this work. I want to begin from the beginning because I like where you start, David, with this pandemic and the origins of the pandemic and this woman, and I'm going to not say her name correctly. I believe it's Aslam Turchi.
Yeah, that's good enough.
Yeah. Set the scene. She is sitting at breakfast and she's reading about this virus in China and she's thinking she may be able to help. How come?
Well, it turns out she and her husband were, they've been like medical students and biology researchers. And they had a medium-sized, not big, not small, a biotech company in Germany. It wasn't in Berlin or Frankfurt. It was in a small town, sort of like in the west of Germany. And they were looking for stuff to do. And they had a new technology, a technology that didn't go right into the DNA, but that went into the little messengers that came out from the DNA called, surprise, surprise, messenger RNA. And they've been trying to use that because it, in theory, it could be really, really nicely honed for something. And when they came across this new news, I think it was in January of last year, and it was a real surprise then. They thought, aha. And it turns out designing a vaccine, coming up with a potential blueprint, that's not so hard. Making it work, that's what takes 6 months or 8 months. In the old days, it would take 10 years. So she and her husband thought, let's do it.
Yeah, well, and the magic of this story for me is that you explained that this type of research that they're doing, there's a bunch of bad actors here, David. There's all kinds of people that work for them could steal. You've got Eastern Europe right next to you. You've got the Russians. And these people are good at stealing all this information.
Totally. I suppose the essence of the book is, how do you survive or even do well in a world where not everybody's a nice guy? And so we know that there's two extremes that don't work. If somebody's really nice and polite, it's good to have as a neighbor, maybe as a spouse, but that won't work in hard or competitive business. You have to keep your door locked. You know, you have to be aware that there's going to be ripoff artists. So we know that purely nice is pleasant, but by itself, it won't get you very far. Maybe you could be a quiet school teacher or something. On the other hand, does that mean you have to go and be a real hard, nasty person? You have to be a real SOB? Because we know that nasty, terrible people can be really successful. Two people are going for a taxi. If I'm meek and gentle, another person is really nasty. They get there at the same time. They'll get the taxi. They will win over me. They will succeed. And nasty people can yell and scream and get their ways. They can fire people with no compunction. So we know that horrible people can succeed in business and finance and law and government, whatever. So there's two extremes. Really sweet and gentle and nice. Nice guys finish last is actually true. Nice guys finish last. On the other hand, the opposite extreme of being horrible. Do you have to go that far? And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting? Is it possible? Is there an intermediate path in all sorts of different fields where you're harder than soft and nice, but not vicious like that? Can you take that path and succeed? And I thought, well, if I just said that, people would say, well, that's fine for Bodanis. He's a quiet writer living in London, England. It's a gentle country. So what, you know? But if I could find 10 examples of people in hard competitive fields who succeeded that way, that'd be really interesting. Then you'd want to think, what's their secret? How do they do it? And the vaccine world, it's right up to date. And as you said, boy, the rewards are billions, plus also the honor and grandeur of saving mankind. So it brings out the worst, you know? It brings out these dangers all around you. So I thought, if I could see how these people navigated the path, And it turns out these people navigated exactly the middle line. They weren't naively soft, but they weren't nasty. And I show at each stage how that succeeded.
And they end up doing very well. I mean, not just financially, they helped the world a lot. Their mRNA was the one that was sold to Pfizer, correct?
Yep. Pfizer did help with some of the testing and marketing, but they came up, they created the vaccine. It was a small, the company in Germany was called BioNTech. The other thing that's really nice is these people, they're German, but they're ethnically Turkish. One was born in Turkey, one was born as a child in Germany. And a little bit after their company was founded, a few years ago, there was a central banker in Germany, a very important person on the equivalent of the Federal Reserve, who wrote a book saying that Turks are awful because they're lowering the collective IQ of our country. Well, by the November of last year, less than a year after they began their research, they got approval, FDA approval, that this thing had worked really well and safely and with great effectiveness in 10,000, 20,000 people. The valuation of what they had was greater than that of Deutsche Bank. So they hadn't done too badly for these people who are going to lower the IQ of Germany.
They might have raised it a point or two, actually.
Yeah. And so all these things, if they had been jerks and like didn't listen to people below them, you know, really, we hate a boss who never listens, then they wouldn't have gotten fresh insights and responded to creativity from the people under them. If you're aggressive to somebody and all you do is take from them, what you get back is resentment. However, if somebody's generous to you, what they get back is beautiful. They get back gratitude. Now, so I talk about there's techniques to make gratitude work. You can't just be generous to everybody. There's a few people that are going to take advantage of you. So you need to audit. You need to check that people aren't ripping you off. But if you have that, I call it street smarts or common sense, then the ethos of generosity is so much better than the ethos of resentment. The whole lab, people are pulling together to try to do it.
Yeah, I felt like I could feel as I was reading this, David, like the whole lab kind of working together collectively. This is not her and her husband's goal. This is a world goal, and they have this opportunity to change everything. And I could feel from your writing, the whole team getting behind them.
Totally. And without that, it doesn't work that well. If you've ever worked in a poisonous organization, people might do the minimum amount so they're not fired, but they're not doing one extra step. They're not going above and beyond the call of duty. A lab technician will be embarrassed to say, ooh, what if we do it slightly differently? I think I can get the readings more quickly. And the scientists will be embarrassed to say, or won't even dare to say, hey, I have a different approach. Let's try it with this different microscope or whatever. But with the right ethos, people pull together. And now to do that, how do you do it? To listen properly, you have to listen without ego. And that's really hard. We love ego. I'm a great believer of standing there in front of the mirror and saying, you beautiful boy. And if the mirror isn't there, we ask other people to do it. We want them to see how impressive we are. There have been certain political leaders in American history, not in the distant past, who were proud of being, who were not known for having a small ego.
Yeah.
The thing is, the ego can't be zero. This couple didn't get their PhDs in Germany. So they had to have, you know, tough skins and really push hard to get it. So they weren't naive. So they had some ego, but they would put it aside in this setting, and they delighted when the people, quote unquote, under them came up with ideas that were as good as theirs or better. They said, this is great. It's pulling in together. There was a beautiful French poet, Saint-Exupéry, who wrote the Little Prince, and he once said, love isn't looking in each other's eyes. Love is looking together in the same direction. And isn't that great?
I think that's fantastic. And you have a few pillars in listening. You mentioned was number one, respect and trust. And I want to dive into those specifically through the first story in the book, because I feel it's such a great illustration of what you're talking about. But even before we get to that, this idea that nice guys finish last, right? There's this famous quote that I've heard, nice guys finish last. Where does that even come from?
Comes from a man who I met, to the advantage of being old, Leo Durocher. Was a American baseball player and then a baseball manager. And in the 1940s, he was sitting in the dugout in New York, and he looked at the opposing team, and they were coming out from their dugout. And he said to a sports reporter next to him, said, look at those guys, nicest guys in the world. They're going to finish last. So the headline writers the next day in one of the New York papers wrote, nice guys finish last. And DeRozier said, yeah, you're going to call me a Scrooge for saying that, but it's true. Nice guys finish last. Well, so I was really interested in that. Turns out, Leo Durocher destroyed his own career by being too much of a not nice guy. So his players hated his guts. I mean, they really hated his guts. In Chicago in 1969, he had a very strong baseball team, and they were number one in the National League East. But the players hated him so much because he wouldn't just say, come on, you can do it, you little weakling. That's a sort of a tease. He would pick on somebody and really get to hurt them. So the shortstop was an Italian-American guy. And Durocher would look at him and say, you know what? Problem, you Italians, you're actually weak. your mother's sweet. There's something wrong.
Oh,
with
Lord.
And, yeah, exactly. And the shark got grabbed by the throat. He said, you can't say that and stuff. One time there was a fan who was sort of insulting DeRozier. Ah, DeRozier, you got a big mouth. So DeRozier nodded to an off-duty cop. The off-duty cop took him to a side room where there was no one else around. And DeRozier started punching the guy in the face so hard he broke his jaw and kept on going. It went to court. And the off-duty cop said, you know, I was saying, Leo, stop, stop. He couldn't. He had that anger. And so the result is his own players hated him. They wouldn't go the extra mile. The umpires really hated him. Somebody once said, DeRozier may not have united the Cubs against the umpires, but he certainly united all the league's umpires against the Cubs. And the opposing team.
It sounds like Billy Martin a little bit.
Yes. And, you know, with ups and downs. And it turns out in that year, the only way that the Cubs could have lost the pennant would be if they lost, I don't know, late August, if they just gave up and they had a terrific lead. I can't remember, 8 games or 12 games or something. And they did. And the team they lost to was the New York Mets, which at that time was a relatively new team. And the guy who ran the Mets was a man named Gil Hodges. And he was known not for being the nicest guy in the league. Remember, nice won't work, but being the most decent guy in the league. And Gil, I'm not sure, I'll call him Gil. He was never loud and emphatic, but it turns out he didn't have to be. Insecure people show off, secure people don't. Hodges had grown up the son of a coal miner, and I think in Pennsylvania or the East Coast, it's tough living. He had served in Okinawa in World War II, had a medal for valor in combat. He was a tough guy. Baseball is a game where you wear flannel pajamas and run around with a stick and a ball, and he knew that. I mean, he took it seriously, but he also knew there were other things more important. So one time, one of his star outfielders was acting up, and it was a doubleheader in the summer. The game wasn't important, and the guy sort of gave up and just didn't really run for a ball. So Gil Hodges wasn't going to insult him, wasn't going to demean him as a person, but he took him off the field then and there, and he took him off the field in the following way. He walked slowly by himself, the manager, across the infield, into the outfield. So the guy, let's walk back. And they walked back the entire stadium watching what was going on. They didn't demean him. Said, you know what, it's, when you push a little bit harder, I think you'll be back on. And that was their star player.
Wow.
And the next day, Gil Hodges started him, said, look, I really mean it. Let bygones be bygones. It's over. I believe in you. And that guy delivered. He really delivered. And in the World Series, he did a spectacular diving, leaping catch at one point. He went the extra mile. You don't have to love somebody to respect them. You don't even have to like them. It's nice if you like them. But if they're dead fair plus competent, you'll follow them anywhere. And that's the beautiful line that in the book, The Art of Fairness, I show a lot of people following.
You know, I'm wondering, and this is not where I was initially going, but as I'm listening to you talk, I'm wondering your thoughts, because you've studied this for so long, not just this project, but I feel like the other projects you've worked on before this have led to this. The role of social media here in a world that's getting more and more mean. Has social media made us meaner quicker as a world?
It's hard to tell. Social media reminds me, I'm not an expert. Again, I'm the wrong demographic. I'm too old. But social media gives me the impression that it acts a little bit like money or beauty. People say that a great beauty or great money, what it does is it magnifies what's already there. So if somebody is it's a bit of a jerk and they get a real lot of money, they'll be a jerk on a large level. They'll boss their friends around. They'll be obnoxious to men or women. You know that sort of person. If they're a really decent person with good values, usually good family values underneath, they got a lot of money, well, they're human. They might be a little bit indulgent. I would get some beautiful bound editions of books, which I don't really need. But hopefully they then use philanthropy. They're fair to people. They're not going to be bossy to waitresses or secretaries or consultants and stuff. They'll still remember that beautiful line, you know, there but for the grace of God go I, that they'll still be have this lowercase d democratic ethos, this notion of reciprocity. And the same thing with somebody who's very beautiful, a woman who's very beautiful, or even a guy who's super handsome, they can often get their way. They put on this charming smile and get their way. They can use it really badly, indulgently to get out of problems, yeah. Or they can use it in a helpful way to encourage and get something good happening. So the same thing I think was with social media.
Yeah, it's just a hype machine. And I think that's what you're saying is that it's just, hey, if you're good, it'll magnify it. If it's bad, it magnifies that too.
Correct. And sort of like the beta in the stock market, the variability, the variation goes up. The danger is the following. Good is it's nice, but it goes up to a certain limit. Bad goes really bad very quickly. And unfortunately, humans have the capacity in private. Our nature is such that we have a bad side that can come out. So we need to be socialized away from that. Little children from whatever family, if they're left alone too long, sort of the Lord of the Flies principle, they'll act up. With the proper reminders, we won't act up, but we know we need and like these reminders. Think of our own self-indulgence. If I want to, I don't know, go to the gym and lose weight, well, I can say I'm going to do that, and probably for a few weeks after January 1st, I'll do it. But if I'm meeting some buddies there regularly, I don't want to let them down. So a social setting can be there. And the problem with social media is it magnifies things strongly through the social setting. It can produce, again, great virtues. People think of people in the army who will sacrifice themselves for their mates. They might not be that generous on their own. They don't have the opportunity, but they're encouraged with others. They can be wonderful, or the opposite, you know, war crimes and stuff. So it magnifies. And unfortunately, our society doesn't yet have the mechanisms to control the bad magnification.
Let's dive into listening. In the first chapter, there is a plane that is piloted by a gentleman named Al Haynes.
And Texas.
To set up this story, can you tell me a little bit about Al Haynes and what's going on at the beginning of this really horrible and great
tale? Yeah, so this is a true story. In the old days, before the pandemic, I used to travel a lot and I always loved airplanes. So I came across this one case of an airliner. It was like, I don't know, 200 or 300 people on board. And it was flying from the West Coast into Chicago. A terrible thing happened when it's at 30,000 feet over the Midwest. Boom. One of the big engines exploded. And it was one of the big jet that had an engine on each wing and an engine back in the middle. They have little hydraulic tubes with liquid under pressure, and that drives it. So these tubes are crucial. Without that, the plane is just a big chunk of metal waiting for Sir Isaac Newton to bring it crashing out of the sky. So engineers are really smart. They make sure that these hydraulic tubes are wrapped in tight steel, and they're totally separate systems for like different parts of the plane. So this particular airplane had three separate hydraulic lines, each one separate, each one wrapped in steel. So in an explosion, wouldn't destroy all three, except there's one point where all three hydraulic lines came together in the tail. That's where the explosion was. The explosion damaged the tail and cut all three hydraulic lines. And in the cockpit, the flight engineer, at that time they had a pilot, co-pilot, and flight engineer, he saw something that they never even put in testing. So the hydraulic fluid was going down, 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 down to zero in every one. He said, but that's impossible. The plane won't fly. And at that moment, all the controls locked. Imagine you're on a curvy road, and whatever your last position of the car was, it's locked. So this airplane, when they realized what was happening, it started turning, tilting to the side. If that continued, the plane turns over, it has no stability, and it crashes from 30,000 feet. So it turned out they managed just to the pilot by a quick reflex. Remember, so there's an engine on each wing and one in the back. The one in the back was no longer working. And as the plane started tilting to the right, he quick put more fuel into the engine to the right. So it went up a little bit more stable. And then something began, a beautiful word I never heard of before. Had you ever heard of the word fugoid before?
I had not heard the word fugoid
before. I read so much. I never heard the word fugoid. Can you say fugoid?
No.
Fugoid. So a fugoid cycle is if you're going in a straight line and you start tilting up a little bit and then you tilt down a little bit and you tilt up a little bit and tilt down a bit. And if you think about an airplane is looking like, say, a pen and it balances on a certain point, the fugoid cycle is it's going up and down the balance point. That's all that's happening. So his fugoid cycle, if he was going horizontally, it wouldn't be so bad. You tilt up a little bit, then you tilt down a little bit, you're back where you started. Uh-uh. His fugoid cycle, they would tilt up, they would rise up maybe about 1,000 feet, they would lose lift, and then they would tilt down and start flying down towards the earth about maybe 5,000 feet. Each time they were losing several thousand feet of altitude. They were going to hit the ground in about 20, 23 minutes, and they couldn't turn the plane. They couldn't aim the plane anywhere. It was just, wasn't going towards any runway. It was just, I think it was maybe over Kansas or something, it was going to hit hard. So the question is, how do you fix it? And the pilot, well, what is our reflex? We're human. We often say, be quiet, let me think, right?
Yeah.
You need a certain amount of thinking.
And this guy, David, is a very seasoned pilot. I mean, he was a pilot in the military, I believe. He had all kinds of training. He knew what he was doing. So I would think your natural reflex would be, I'm the smartest person in the room, back away from me.
Correct. And sometimes that works. Sometimes a really experienced person, it's wise for them to do it. And the thing is, the first things he tried quickly, he had the honesty to realize they weren't working. They could tug as much as they wanted. It's like when you went from power steering to manual. But suppose it was like, I don't know, like a huge tank. You cannot run that on manual. It's just, you can't. You can maybe tug a 1,200-pound car, not a 50-ton tank. So then he had to do the following thing. He had to bring in other sources of information, but he couldn't be passive before them. You remember, you want to be nice, but you can't be too soft. You want to be fair, but you don't want to be. So if he listened to everybody, if he listened to the co-pilot, and it turns out there was a trainee pilot on board, like a kid who had a young man who hadn't flown much, who came up to the cockpit, didn't want his help. And the air hostess, the stewardess, they had ideas. That wasn't right.
He also knows, by the way, the stakes here as he's finding these people. I think I read that he knew that nobody had survived this before.
Exactly. Because you can't, because it isn't a matter of skill. If you're locked in, and you're going on a Fugloy cycle that's going down, every cycle is maybe like 2 or 3 minutes, and you're losing a few thousand feet each time, you are going to hit the ground and you can't aim return the plane. That's what was so frustrating.
Yeah.
You can't even say, okay, I'm heading towards a runway. I'll try to get the tilt just to the right point. So he knew that it was no good.
Yeah.
It turns out on the airplane, there was a guy who'd been an instructor pilot for the airline who was sitting in back, and he came up and said, could I help? And the pilot, Al Hang, said, yeah, man, let's do it. And also he listened when it was appropriate to the co-pilot and to the flight engineer. They tried speaking to their engineering headquarters in San Francisco, but unfortunately, no disrespect for the people at headquarters, those people couldn't grasp it. They said, we have no hydraulic fluid, the pilot said. And they said, there's a problem on the line. It sounded like you said you have no hydraulic fluid. You can't be in the air without hydraulic fluid. They said, no, we have none. Sorry, that's not possible. So it's like they couldn't get help from them. So the pilot had to work out, was there something from the instructor pilot that he could learn from? Was there any information from the ground control at the airport that they wanted to turn towards?
And to do it in about 5 minutes.
Yeah, and you had to do it all really quickly. And it turns out there was a black box recording much of the conversation. Should I say what happened? Or should I just say, read the book?
No, actually, let's finish this story because there's so many other stories. I mean, the story of the Empire State Building is amazing. The story of, and we're not going to get to the Olympics and Danny Boyle and Sebastian Coe, which I thought was also very compelling. There's so many great stories, but let's finish this one off.
Well, it turns out I've sat on a horse for fun. I can't call myself a horse rider, but people who are a horseman or horsewomen are often very good pilots. The Air Force often recognizes that, or private pilots recognize that. There's a sort of touch. And with a horse also, if you act like a horrible bully, you might get a certain complacency, but you know, you won't get that much. Good horse, good jockeys, good riders, they know what they're doing. They have a connection. It's a little bit like a connection somebody might have with the dog, but more so. The guy who was the instructor pilot, Al Haynes had him stand between the pilot and the co-pilot and put a hand on each of the throttles, which control the fuel to the left-hand engine and the right-hand engine. And he just let that guy get a feel for it. And it turns out, as that man standing there holding each of the throttles got a feel, he realized, oh, I see. We have these Fugloy cycles. We're going up, we're going down. But there's a point where I can just slightly put a little bit more fuel on one side or another, and I can sort of get a little bit of a turn going. So we can sort of turn in the direction of the airport we want. We're facing, like, you know, in the wrong direction. It's north of us. We're facing east. And I just accelerate a little bit on the right-hand side, and we turn a little bit. And then he overshot, so they had to do some more circles. But eventually, they sort of, as the Fugloy was bringing him down, 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 they were beginning to turn towards the direction of the airport. One of the sad things about it, which is very poignant, is the airline was having a promotion for children that week. And so there are a lot of children on board. And at one point, one of the pilots or co-pilot had to go to the back of the plane just to check, was there any chance that there might be some residual fuel, hydraulic fluid left somewhere? And as he walked by, he saw that some of the parents, to be honest, the mothers, had made little cushion piles for their babies to put them on the floor. And if you impact at 500 miles an hour, that has no effect.
Doesn't matter.
So it was a hell of a thing. Anyways, it turns out these were superb pilots. And people who've studied aviation history, so this is one of the best examples of piloting that there was. So they landed, and they landed hard. They almost landed at the right point in the Fugloy cycle, and they were just about to tilt up. And this airline, they were so good, the pilots, Al Hangs and the others, they were almost flared just before, but unfortunately another Fugloy began, and they slammed down. They slammed down so hard that the wheel cut, I think it was 16 or 18 inches, into the cement runway. Could you imagine that? Kind of hard. And so the plane hit, a wing hit, it fell apart, it flipped, blah, blah, blah. Turned out, sadly, something like 100 people died, but happily, something like 150 people lived.
And by the way, the numbers, the specific numbers in your book, 112 people passed away, which is horrible, mm-hmm. but it was 188 lived. Amazing. Amazing.
And it turned out, so there were the firemen and everybody were there racing around, and they were racing to the main body of the airplane because they had managed to reduce the speed and get it lined up. And there was one place where they thought there should be nothing. There's this crushed metal box at one point. As they went by, they heard sounds from it. And there was the cockpit. And it turned out they managed to prize it open. And the pilot and co-pilot and flight engineer and this this instructor were there. They were alive. They were wounded. But all of them, within a year or two, were mobile and went back to being pilots.
That's so amazing. I found, because every time you hear about any crash, the pilots are always dead.
For sure. And the key thing there, the principle, was that listening without ego. So think about that sort of that middle line. he had to put his ego aside and say, look, if you can help me, this is great for our higher task. We're looking in the same direction. On the other hand, even with highly skilled people, you have to have a synthesis. It's sort of like in a good committee meeting. Committees usually fall apart because if you have somebody soft running it, all you get is everybody blabbing. And if you have an alpha running it, nobody gets to say anything. So you need somebody in between. So L. Haynes would elicit the information, then he'd make an executive decision, and then he'd have people assess it. And he did that quickly over and over as they refined and got better and better and better and had that as close to success as you can get.
You talk about this goes along with the stuff that General Stanley McChrystal wrote about a few years ago with chess versus gardening, where you really yes. need to plant a garden versus moving chess pieces.
Correct.
And kind of listen
you
to
have it. Have a certain, yes, you have a sort of certain modesty in raising children and educating people in letting a business division work properly. Think about it from the other side. These books are often written for the dictators at the top. Imagine we're like the poor nebbish at the bottom or the plant growing or the student or the person new at a company. We love when the manager gives us our head, gives us discretion. Now, the organizers, they still need some control. They need to make that final decision. But if they give you that space, if they put their ego aside and listen, if they give you the opportunity, you'll have your energy and your gratitude will just pour right out.
David, I've studied your work and I feel like this brings to a head lots of the stuff that you've already talked about in the past about creativity, how society changes. Did this verify things that you already thought, or what did you learn through the process of writing this book and doing this project?
What I learned is how narrow this successful path is. And I know even for myself, so I've never really run any big organizations or managed anything, but I've tangentially been involved with some stuff. And you can read all these beautiful things. You can read the Sermon on the Mount in the New Testament. You can read these beautiful, beautiful words and agree with them entirely, but it's deadline and you're pressured and people are acting like jerks and stuff. So it's easy to just forget all of that and be bossy. And it's not counterproductive. In the short term, it works. Get up, move on and do this. People will jump and they'll do it. In the long term, you're just storing up resentment. They do not like you and they're not going to show initiative. And you develop the wrong sort of habits and stuff. I think what I learned was that some people manage to have the self-control to get this right path. And it's not a phony self-control. It isn't like a sweet, syrupy tone that isn't real. Nobody likes bosses like that. Yeah. You almost want somebody who's willing to be mean. And I think I mentioned, we were saying earlier, that you don't have to like the boss. What you want is a mixture of competency and fairness. Suppose there's a doctor, or suppose there's a boss at the work or something who's all syrupy and stuff, but they don't follow through. You don't like it. Or they really are, they are consistently nice, but they're clueless. They can't lead you in the right direction. Think of someone like Stanley McChrystal. If I was ever the great American general, if I was ever lost behind the enemy lines, I would like it very much if it was with Mr. McChrystal. I hope he's a nice, pleasant man. I've never met him, but I don't care if he's a nice, pleasant man. I want this man who will get me out of that situation. Then whether we hug or not is a separate matter.
You want Al Haynes flying that plane. The book is called The Art of Fairness, The Power of Decency in a World Turned Mean. And the stories, your gift as a storyteller, I know you already know this, is just amazing. I was there on the edge of my seat. Available everywhere?
Yes, indeed.
Awesome. David, thanks a ton for taking time out of your busy schedule to hang out with us for a few minutes in Mom's basement. I appreciate it.
Greatest pleasure.
Hey, this is Andy Hill from the Marriage, Kids, and Money podcast. And when I'm not singing Disney karaoke songs with my kids at home, I'm stacking Benjamins.
Doug in the hot jokes. Maybe Diana, I know, is going to be here on Friday. Maybe Diana can do some heat jokes a little better. We shall see.
Time will tell.
Yes, we will make it a competition. Hey, big thanks again to David Bodanis. Collaboration, listening, and respect. It's so difficult. It's so, so difficult to know when to take other people's input and when not to. And how do you say, well, that person is just the blank, so I'm not going to listen to them, versus that person can help. Having the ability to decide where your information comes to, but doing it without prejudice.
Yeah. Well, it's a sign of a good leader. I mean, when you increase other people's confidences along the way, you know, then people also will share in your ability to be able to, you know, self-regulate, if you will. Like, think about like, yeah, I shouldn't show off here. This isn't my expertise. Or, you know, Joe has empowered me and trust me, and this is an area of my expertise. So I am going to kind of bring it a little bit here, because I am kind of the smartest person in the room on this topic, even though I'm the most junior person. But that stuff starts that empowerment, that confidence building starts long before the need for it arrives.
That's a great, great point. Like, you've got to get to that inflection point where you not only need them, but they feel confident enough to speak up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great stuff. I was so happy that we got to talk to David to kick off these 8 weeks. And man, if you think that was fun, wait till you see what we've got coming up. By the way, if you want a guide to everything that we talked about with David and our headlines and the TikTok video, all kinds of links that round out your experience, we've got our free stacker guide, stackybenjamins.com/stacker. And you'll get not just the links from the show notes, but also Brooke loads that with lots of additional information to round out your knowledge on anything that interests you on our shows. Hey, let's throw out the Haven Lifeline OG and tackle some of life's most important questions. Our friends at Haven Life Insurance Agency, they put what you value first.
Sharing with everybody my confidence.
And landing the plane. Yep. It's your loved ones in your time, but I can see how you could juxtapose those. It's why they've created a modern way to buy quality term life insurance. Go to stackybenjamins.com/Haven Life. Now you'll get a free quote. Prices are affordable. All policies issued by their parent company, Mass Mutual. Application is easy to complete online, and they give you an instant coverage decision. You don't have to wait several weeks. You can get it right away. And by the way, their customer support, absolutely amazing with our friends over at Matt and the team over there at Haven Life. Hey, today we're going to dive into our Facebook group, The Basement. Leia had a question that a lot of us may be feeling right now if we're thinking about real estate, about buying a new house, and wanted to get your take on this, OG. Leia says, I'd like to buy a house now for purely personal, practical, emotional reasons that have nothing to do with the market. And I love that she can identify that. That's an aside on my part. Back to Leia. She says, I understand my home loan will be a liability, not an asset, as it will not generate income. I don't plan to house hack or rent out rooms, also for personal reasons. I have enough cash for the down payment. I earn enough to afford the mortgage. I will still have a 6-month emergency fund. What kills me is the awful, awful timing of the market appearing to be at its height at the same exact time when I'm finally ready to and need to buy a home. I have a sense of dread about buying at the top of the market. It seems really foolish. But once again, my goal is not flipping or investing, etc. Can anyone give me advice? Should I wait a year? I just feel I'm truly wasting money on rent at my age and my station in life. Thanks for any advice. I want to, well, first of all, let's get your overall take. And then there's a couple things in here that Leia talks about, OG, that I'd like to dive into as well.
I think firstly, you have to recognize that you're not throwing away money on rent. The rent payment is substantially less than what your house payment will be with all of the other stuff that goes into house ownership. It's not throwing it away. You're actually saving money. It's afforded you the opportunity to save the money to get the down payment on a house, frankly. And I think when you start using words like now I have to, or because I'm so old, I must, as it relates to financial goals, then, you know, you're kind of already deciding in your mind, right? When you say things like, well, I'm finally at the point that I need to buy a house. Well, nobody needs to buy a house. I mean, nice to have one, and you know, you can move your stuff one last time, and you know, you can stay there for 40 years and paint it whatever color you want. And like, all that's great, but you don't need to do that. You need to have food. You need to have water. You don't need to own a house. And if you change the vocabulary just a smidge, you know, the words matter a little bit, I think you'll find the answer to your own question. Now, whether or not the housing market goes up or down or sideways from here, I don't think anybody knows. And it certainly is very hyper-local. In certain areas, I can't see the market going down for a long time. In other areas, you look and you go, how are prices so high over here? You know, when you think about just demographic trends and the where people are moving from and moving to, I think it stands to reason that there are certain areas that might continue to go up. But by the same token, if it does go down and you're looking at it as a, from a long-term perspective, so be it, you know? You will kind of feel a little flabbergasted, I guess, that you decided to buy at the exact peak. But if that's the concern that you have to weigh that against whether or not a year from now, if prices are another 10% higher, if you're more upset by that and you wait for the inevitable, or in your mind, the inevitable crash, this is no different than trying to time out the stock market. Housing market is not nearly as robust as the total valuation of all of the publicly traded companies in the entire world, but it's a lot. There's a lot of houses. and betting on the houses to go down in value over long periods of time, I think is a losing
bet. Not a great bet. Yeah. Well, here's what I was thinking. Leia waits a year. She waits 12 months. Prices do continue to go up for 11 of those months. They come down and she times it right, but it's still higher than it is today.
Yeah. And again, it just depends on where you are and what you're looking for. I mean, if you're trying to buy a $3.5 million oceanfront house, I think there's wide variability in those prices. If you're trying to buy a 3-bedroom, 2-bath colonial in downtown USA where 10,000 people a year move to, I don't think there's going to be as much price volatility because lots of people need 3-bedroom, 2-bath houses. Not a lot of people need $3 million condos on the water. See, I use the word need again. I think there's a less likelihood that there's wild price swings. I mean, the last time that we saw a big housing change was in 2007 and 2008. So I think betting on the lowering of prices in the long run is a pretty foolish bet. I'd buy the house, to be honest.
Yeah, I think if it's a big decision, Leia, you're going to second guess it no matter what it is because it's so much money.
Yeah.
And I think second guess it, there's nothing wrong with second guessing it because you need to make sure that you're doing it for the right reasons. And I love the fact that she notices, OG, that it's not a savings. It's not an asset that she's counting for net worth. She understands the mortgage implications. I feel like she's thought through it.
And there's nothing wrong with taking your time and being deliberate. You know, you can go hire a realtor, lay out the parameters, and start looking at houses. You don't have to buy the first one that you walk into. Frankly, you probably won't be able to, you know, because there'll be so many other competing bids. So you're not going to be able to do it anyway. I know when we bought our house, one of the things that we decided to do was to narrow down the community. And we did that by going to open houses every single week for a long time. Once we narrowed down the community and we said, okay, this seems to be the place we want to go, we went and toured every house that was available for sale for 7 months in the town or in the community that we wanted to buy in, every single one. And what we figured out was a couple of things. We figured out, number one, who the realtor was that actually did all the stuff. You know, because you drive up and down the street and you see different signs and they all kind of blur together. But if you see the same person every weekend or every other weekend for 6 straight months, you go, that person's the player here.
They know the neighborhood.
And I think that helped us quite a bit when we did buy this house because the guy's name was Mike and his wife, Pam. And they said, hey, this house is perfect for you guys. We've seen your kids. We know what you're interested in. And we found this one for you. In fact, there was a time that we saw this house. We were at another place and he said, can you hang out for 30 more minutes? I want to drive you over to this other one. I think you'd like better. And that was because we had seen this person, you know, this realtor, he and his wife.
They knew you.
We had seen him, you know, 24 times.
Same thing happened with us when we moved back to Texarkana with Amy, who was the person that sold our house when we left here.
Yeah, I think any chance that you have to be deliberate about it is probably better. And it also gives you a sense of trying to figure out exactly what it is that you do want. Because right now you're focused on the price and the savings and I've reached this goal and now I got to go buy this house. But do you prefer wood floors or carpeting? Do you want granite countertops or quartz? Do you think that crown molding is good or bad? You know, do you need an acre or a tenth of an acre lot? Do you want a 2-car garage or carport? Okay. Like these are the things that you haven't thought about yet. And by going out and finding the area in which you want to live, which P.S. live close to all the stuff, like your work and your church and your, you know, don't commute if you can avoid it. But if you see enough houses, you'll start piecing together like, I like that. I don't like that. I can see how that would be functional. I never thought about that along the way. So just have some fun with it.
Hey, if you've got a question for us, and by the way, thanks to Leia for taking that to our community. You can take it to our community, which is our Facebook group, The Basement. A lot of very nice people there. StackyBenjamins.com/basement is the link to get you there. I think it's Joe's Mom's Basement, or you can just go to Facebook and put in the name Stacking Benjamin's Basement and it will come up, our private group. But a better way to do it is to go to our voicemail, the Haven Lifeline, StackyBenjamins.com/voicemail. And then we'll send you some greatest money show on earth classic swag. Actually, it's V2, which means it's collectible. And if you got the early stuff, it's even more collectible. I'm sure like NFTs are making money hand over fist. That first edition t-shirt probably making a bunch of money too.
Got one on right now, as a matter of fact.
And when we, well, yours is the 3-town tour. Speaking of that, we're getting ready to go back on tour. We're going to begin announcing this a few times, but if you would like to join us in Cincinnati, it's the Economy Conference. We're going to be kicking it off on the 12th. And by the way, the room already OG, nearly a quarter filled. And this is the first time that we've announced it on the show. So head to economyconference.com. You will see a link to buy tickets for our show. It's an add-on ticket to the conference. By the way, you probably want to stick around for the conference as well. 2 days. That's like a big financial geek party with Diana Merriam and company there. But Cincinnati, November 12th, economyconference.com for the ticket to the show and a ticket to Economy. Two separate tickets. All right. Last but not least, if you're looking for better financial help in your corner as we round the turn into the home stretch, unbelievable that we're saying that.
It's crazy.
For 2021, where did it go? StackingBenjamins.com/OG is the link to OG's team because he and his team are taking clients.
About time to get started on 2022 already.
It totally is. So if you want better financial decisions in 2022 and beyond, StackingBenjamins.com/OG. And that's the first step to seeing how they interface with you to make those better decisions. All right. That's going to do it for today. A lot of people to thank, but Doug, you're going to take it from here, man, because we're getting out of the heat. Let's go. What should we have learned today?
So what should we have learned today? First, take a lesson from our headline. Gamification? It's helpful as long as the people making it are helping you make moves that are in your best interest, which also means that just because it's fun doesn't mean it's good for you. Wow, actually, sounded like Joe's mom there. Ugh. Second, take a lesson from David Bodanis. Listening is a key part of any success story if you're looking to bring others to success with you. In some cases, like in his story today, it can even save lives. But the big lesson? It's amazing that once David Bodanis talks about listening, now these guys are all about listening. Yeah, right. To learn more about our guests and for more resources, you can head to our show notes page at stackingbenjamins.com. To learn more about David Bodanis' amazing work, check out his new book, The Art of Fairness, wherever books are sold. This show is the property of SB Podcasts, LLC, copyright 2021, and is created by Josal Sehi. Our producer is Karen Rapine. The show is written by Taylor Stevens with help from Joe and Doc G from the Earn and Invest podcast. After you listen, check out our show notes page written by our website manager and blog editor, Brooke Miller. Brooke and Joe also collaborate on a guide to the show and with lots of extras we couldn't include on today's podcast. Heck, they'll also throw in some life money lessons from Joe, and it's all free. It's called The Stacker, and you'll find it at stackingbenjamins.com/stacker. Once we get all of this goodness bottled up, it goes over to our engineer, the amazing Steve Stewart, who helps the rest of our team sound nearly as good as I do right now. Want to talk about the show later? Mom's friend Gertrude is the room mother in our Facebook group, The Basement. She also is our social media coordinator, so say hello when you see us posting online. Here's a weird fact. She and Tina Eichenberg are never in the same room at the same time. For a URL that'll take you right to our Facebook group, by the way, type stackingbenjamins.com/basement. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, saying, see you next time, folks.
we talked earlier about AMC with record crowds, and that's based on Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings. Guess who's got two thumbs and went to see it, OG?
I'm going to go you.
Yeah, this guy. Let's give it a listen.
I know that you don't like to talk about your life, but a guy with a freaking machete for an arm just chopped our butts in half. Who are you?
Run it. On September 3rd,
my father trained me to be an assassin, but that's not who I am.
A Marvel legend. DJ Snake, everybody's great. Will rise.
You got this.
Thank you.
You can't outrun your destiny.
My name is Shang-Chi.
Shang-Chi.
Shang.
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 S-H-A-N-G. Shang.
That's what I said.
Marvel Studios Shang-Chi and the Legend of the
Aquafina, in a lot of ways, steals the show. OG, one of my favorite comedic actors. And she plays the friend of Shang-Chi, who is reluctant to share with his friends what family he comes from. And he comes from a very powerful family, a mother who historically has been very good, and a dad who has done some very, we'll call it bad stuff, but has kind of come around to being good. And then through the results of a big misunderstanding creates a global crisis that Shang-Chi has to save. I know that doesn't sound like a Marvel movie plot at all. Reluctant hero has to save everybody. And what's funny is that a friend of mine that we went to see it with, Rick said, he's like, the plot was pretty formulaic. And I got out of the film and I didn't even realize how formulaic it was, because it's so pretty and it's so funny. I can see why critics are giving this such a high ranking for a Marvel movie, because I was in it. I enjoyed it. I am so sick of Marvel movies. I can't tell you how sick of Marvel movies I am. Will I still take out my wallet and go see everyone? Yes, I will.
Sure will.
Yeah. And why? Because they're fun. And it's funny because I did not see the latest DC film. Like, I don't know why I have interest in Marvel movies and not in the DC comic films. I don't know. Don't know. I saw Aquaman. I thought that was cool. Actually, I take that back. I also saw Wonder Woman 76, which was absolutely horrible, or 82, Wonder Woman 82, 84, whatever it takes. I don't remember. What was the Wonder Woman year attached to that?
Unsure.
That horrible movie.
Don't see a DC movie.
Yeah, just not that great. So Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings, big thumb up from me. I can see why people pack theaters. I'm sure that people early on Labor Day weekend told their friends to go see it. Like I'm telling you as my friend to go see it, because it's a ton of fun. I think you guys, OG, the OG family, I think you'll really like it.
Okay. When I feel like going to a theater again, I will.
Yeah. And what's bad is we tried to have a party at our house because, as you know, Cruella came out and the Black Widow movie came out on Disney Plus and you could just buy it. You couldn't buy this one. And so we actually scheduled the party for our house thinking that we could buy it. And then we did the research and found out that, and I don't know if it's Scarlett Johansson's lawsuit, which is outside the scope of this show, but yeah, Scarlett Johansson sued them because she gets a portion of the receipts from the theater. And apparently streaming it on Disney Plus was not part of that deal.
Don't mess with the Black Widow.
Go see it. Well, I hope you got a lot out of today's episode, but one thing that we talked about a little bit today, but we talk about a lot, is you got to have good partners on your team, Stackers. And you know what? Navy Federal Credit Union could be that partner, because becoming a member at Navy Federal Credit Union could help you earn more and save more. And aren't those two of the big tenets, right? Have a debt strategy, earn more, save more. Their certificate options could earn you more than standard savings accounts with competitive rates. Not all financial institutions offer you as many choices for savings options as Navy Federal does. For example, you can start your savings journey with a low minimum deposit, add money at any time, and watch your savings grow. I think that's the coolest certificate. Thanks to flexible terms, you can use Navy Federal savings options for all kinds of goals, short or long term. Considering a big home improvement project, Maybe you want to consolidate debt. Well, as you're putting your plan together, you want to also have a debt strategy, right? And you could borrow up to 100% of your home's equity with a fixed rate home equity loan with zero closing cost, or easily borrow as you go with a home equity line of credit. Don't get in over your head with debt. Make sure you have a great strategy and then take out debt as you need it. And Navy Federal's options certainly give you the flexibility to help you make life's big expenses seem more manageable. To learn more, visit NavyFederal.org. At Navy Federal, our members are the mission. Navy Federal is insured by NCUA, equal housing lender, membership required, terms and conditions apply, loan subject to approval.